The Rambam was, who was, what's his name, right? Moses Maimonides, Maimonides being son of Moshe ben Maimon, or Rebbe Moshe ben Maimon, hence Rambam. He also was beloved, basically the whole Mediterranean Jewish world, and so he achieved a number of other monikers, my favorite being Hanefer HaGadol, the Great Eagle, which he was known by, and he was so beloved towards the end of his life by the Yemenite Jewish community that his name was included in the Kaddish. There was like, you know, may we in the community be well, and may Moshe ben Maimon be. It was an incredible thing. We'll get to that later on. He lived from 1135 or 1138, depending on who you ask, until 1204, right? This is generally the case with historical figures, that we know with a lot more precision the year and often even the day on which they died, because by that point they were famous. But when they were born, no one knew they were going to be famous. So no one, back when, you know, record keeping was expensive or even impossible, birth dates were not recorded. His family, he was born in what we would call Spain today, Iberia, and then traveled as he was a boy and a young man. His family traveled kind of down into Morocco and then across North Africa and ended up in old Cairo, Fustat, as it's known, spent a little bit of time in the land of Israel. And part of the reason that that's significant, I realize I'm about to open something huge that we may not, we're not really going to be able to kind of contain. No one really knows quite what to do with it. Here is what we know about, so the Almohads, where actually the root comes from, the Had. They were the unificationers, unifiers. They were a Muslim theological and political group that had a distinctive and kind of Muslim sect. And unlike standard Muslim kind of practices of pluralism, in which Jews and Christians, as people of the book, were allowed to live in the land, not as full citizens, but as kind of a resident alien status called dhimmi, as people of the book. The Almohads did not permit any non-Muslims to live in their territories, a radical departure from traditional practice, political practice. The reason this is particularly significant is because Maimonides lived about 10 years of his life in Almohad al-Andalus, so the western part of Europe and Africa. And which means it probably stands to reason that Maimonides lived for 10 years of his life as someone living with a social identity as a Muslim, which is a shocking and surprising thing. And the and some evidence corroborating this idea that Maimonides lived a segment of his life as an outward Muslim is that late in his life, he was brought up on capital charges in Egypt, i.e. there was a death penalty case brought against him with him as the defendant, and he had to kind of call in all the political favors to wiggle out of this. And it's hard to think of what capital offense Maimonides might have committed or was likely to commit, except for the one that apostasy from Islam, it was a capital offense at the time, i.e. a person who was a Muslim or had been a Muslim in a previous era, who was now living as a Jew, would be subject to the death penalty. And so this kind of added into what we know about the Almohad time earlier in his life seems to suggest that what probably happened is someone who knew Maimonides as a young man, Morocco, Iberia, as a Muslim, came, appeared in Egypt and was prepared to deliver testimony that the head of the Jews was, in fact, a Muslim apostate. This is a very interesting, exciting, and I hope in some ways unsettling way to think about the greatest philosopher, in some ways greatest legal thinker, greatest mind of the Jewish tradition. Maimonides spent most of his time and effort working within the Jewish community for about a decade. He was Ra'is al-Yahud, the head of the Jewish community, meant that he was the final legal authority. That authority was devolved on him by the Sultan, which meant marriages and divorces and inheritances and school teacher positions were all under his aegis. And he also served as a doctor and physician to the king and the royal court and produced. For example, one of the tasks he was given was to produce a book of poison antidotes local to Egypt, because the standard ones required many ingredients that were not available because of the restrictions of local flora. So I know he produced a one that was locally available. He produced a massive literary output. He wrote early works on logic, medicine. His earliest Jewish work is the commentary on the Mishnah, which he completed around the age of 25. So if you want to feel bad about yourself, you can think about it. And revised continually throughout his life. He wrote that in Arabic. His next major work is the Mishneh Torah, which is written in a very pristine rabbinic Hebrew, which is essentially a literary compilation of all of rabbinic normative and halachic works. Is the first work of its type, basically, to organize everything conceptually. And then his last great work, also in Arabic, is the Guide to the Perplexed, which itself is an successful attempt at an earlier failed book. And what I mean by that is in the commentary on the Mishnah, where he says, I want to write a great legal code, and I want to write a book that will explain all of the difficult agadot, the rabbinic stories and theological passages. And he later wrote that he abandoned that project, and what we'll talk about why a little bit, or it morphed into the Guide, probably more accurately. Now, part of the reason I'm telling you this is that there are certain schools of thought that try to kind of read it as a different Maimonides, an exoteric Maimonides, an esoteric Maimonides, a public Maimonides, and a private Maimonides, early and late. And I think I'm not of that school of thought. I think there's a tremendous amount of continuity, which we'll mostly observe throughout reading his works. I want to share a personal moment of connection to Maimonides, and then a little bit more broadly about my relationship with him, and then some of the framework for what we're going to do today as an entryway into the class. One of the moments that I remember most distinctly as a 23-year-old living in Male Gilboa in northern Israel and studying in the yeshiva was spending basically an entire week of mourning, so, you know, about 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., trying to understand how Maimonides, who was living about 850 years prior to me, interpreted a certain section of Talmud, which was written about 850 years prior to him. And I have never experienced outside of that as pure a sense of stepping outside of the flow of time, right? Of being that I was with Maimonides in Cairo in the 12th century, and he was with Rava and Abaye in, you know, Persia in the 4th century. And I hope we'll all have some of that. In some ways, he represents the most accessible and compelling way into the tradition. And that's part of what I hope we'll experience, that there's something radically accessible about who he was and what he thought and wrote and was trying to do, I think. And I hope you will all feel the kind of contours of time blurring between the past. Now, I want to say a little bit more specifically, and this is a bit of a warning to all, is there is a sense, which I'll try to lay out a lot of today, that I am a Maimonidean. I'm not really a joiner or a follower, and yet I am a Maimonidean. And I say that by way of warning, that it is hard for me to be impartial or hear criticism of Maimonides. I mean, I can offer some of it, a measured amount. But just so you should know, you kind of come in knowing some of the pre-existing relationships in the room, as it were. And I only mean that in a very specific sense, so, which I hope will become clear. And then the last thing which I want to just kind of suggest that we'll see, and I hope we'll kind of cast out and explore in different ways, is the thing that is important about Maimonides is his radicalness. And this is why, if you look in the reception history, you get many figures, you know, in the 17th and 18th century who claim that Maimonides could not have been the author of the Guide because the author of the Guide was a heretic. There's even a kind of an oral tradition that Rabbi Nachman of Breslov said that the Mashiach will reveal that the Rambam was a heretic, a different version of the same idea. Some Kabbalists to say that Maimonides would be reincarnated as a worm because of his punishment for his heresy. So there is this kind of, and this is actually kind of shocking and tragic. Yes, I'm trying to slow down a bit. The very first book burnings in Christian Europe are Jews in the 13th century burning Maimonides' works. What was going on is called the Maimonidean controversy. It breaks out in Spain. The Ramban gets involved. Nachmanides, because a group of liberal-minded Jews are citing Maimonides as authority for their less than full observance. And this becomes kind of an all-out pitched battle over religious difference. And one of the blows that is struck against them as Maimonides' works are burned by the organized Jewish community. So the reason I'm saying that is, to the extent that you're finding something shocking in what we read, you're probably getting it right. And to the extent that it feels familiar and expected and normal, you're probably missing the point. That makes sense. It's trying to unsettle your perceptions. And this is strange because we're used to Maimonides showing up on source sheets with other texts and being cited and studied a lot in very, very traditional contexts. And so I want to open your expectations as to what's possible. And you'll see at different points, we will have, today Judith Plaskow makes an appearance on the source sheet. There will be some queer thinkers later on. Plaskow, actually, her later work comes out as a lesbian and incorporates queerness into her thinking and writing, but not in the piece we're going to see today. And my experience is that those types of frameworks are actually the most fruitful for understanding who Maimonides was and what his project is vis-a-vis Judaism. So what I want to do today is talk about the perplexity that Maimonides experiences, to understand what the kernel, the germ of his project is, or to use the image of a pearl, right? The irritant, which gets things going. So we're going to read very slowly. and basically everything we're going to read is in English. Maimonides, as I mentioned, wrote all of his philosophical work in Arabic. You know, a fun thing about Jewish philosophy is all of the most important works were written in non-Hebrew languages. Guide is in Arabic. The Khuzari is in Arabic. Rosenzweig, Star, Redemption, Buber's I and Thou, Shimshon, Raphael, Hirsch, all written, those latter ones are written in German. It's actually fascinating. Thing to think about.
The first purpose of this treatise is to explain the meanings of certain terms occurring in books of prophecy to a religious person for whom the validity of our Torah has become established in her soul and has become actual in her belief. Such a person, being perfect in her religion and character, and having studied the sciences of the philosophers and come to know what they signify. The human intellect having drawn her on and led her to dwell within its province, she must have felt distressed by the externals of the Torah.
Break this down. So the first purpose here does not mean there are three things I'm trying to accomplish, the first, the second, and the third. This means what we might call the final purpose, the goal, and there will be many steps along the way that are necessary to, okay, Emily noticed the her and the she. That is my license that I took as a translator. I believe the term he is not gender neutral. And so, to translate those terms accurately, I mean, it never was, but it was used linguistically that way. You need to kind of alternate between masculine and feminine pronouns, which is what you see. I hope it'll become standard. And, in a long time, it'll be normal feeling. But the feminist frame will be important throughout here. So the purpose of this treatise, the goal, is to explain the meanings of certain terms. Now, we're going to get to why we need to in a second, but first we need to get to who needs this explanation. So we have a person who's characterized as a religious person, right, who believes that the Torah is valid in their soul and actual in their belief. Great. So that's the person who's, I think religious is a great descriptor. We don't need to add anything to that. Perfect in her religion and character, and now things are going to get interesting. Having studied the sciences of the philosophers, and come to know what they signify. So such a person additionally is, shaking complacency, very good. Such a person is additionally learned in what we might call secular realms, although Maimonides would reject that term, but he's broadly learned, general studies, as it's called, things that are, specifically for Maimonides, it's the Aristotelian tradition. For us, it's a much richer life world of ideas. And now watch this. The human intellect having drawn her on, there's actually a description of an eros here, right? And led her to dwell within its province. It's not just that the person thinks, right? The intellect actually is the subject of these verbs and has drawn you in. You feel under its power in a certain way, which I think we've all felt in certain ways, many forces, including the intellect. She must have felt distressed by the externals of the Torah. So this person is religious. They believe in the validity of the Torah. They have learned certain things, which are a core part of who they are. They're not just facts that they know, but they're descriptors. They're become a part of who they are as a person. And that very deep
relationship, deep identification with the intellect, is now causing tension with certain things they read and see in the Torah. And the first thing I want to point out is for Maimonides, this distress is an achievement. Right? There are some people, if we could just turn off the screen share for a quick second, Andrew. Right? There are many people who do not feel distress when they read the Torah, and those people lead impoverished lives. What are the externals of the Torah? Good, secular reading. So good, Maimonides does not use the term pshat ever, but the external is the plain sense. There was a garden with a snake that had legs and talked, right? That is the external meaning of the Torah. We'll talk more about how Maimonides thinks about parables, which is what he thinks the Torah is a parable. What he means by that is very interesting, or it's a set of parables. But that there is an inner meaning, which is different from the external meaning. The inner meaning is not distressing. If you understand it, it's comforting and inspiring. But the external meaning, what it seems to say, is distressing. Now, I would encourage you all here to start thinking of the times when you are this reader. So, you know, for me, I would list as somewhere right close to Exhibit A, that the Torah says that it is not just permitted, but it is a mitzvah to keep slaves from among the neighboring nations. That is an external of the Torah that is distressing, right? The divine mandate of genocide against other nations, Deuteronomy, parts of Exodus, distressing, et cetera, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That, you know, a young woman who is found not to be a virgin on her wedding night is to be executed, distressing, right? So Maimonides is opening a window here to the affective experience of being a reader, that it hurts at times. And now, interestingly, Maimonides agrees with certain figures who today we might call ultra-Orthodox, that if you read things, go and read things that aren't Torah, you may come to think that the basic ideas of the Torah are bad. Standard ultra-Orthodox response is to say, don't read those things that make you feel pain when you read the Torah. Maimonides saying, no, it's good to read those things. So now what Maimonides is going to do in the next paragraph is he's going to lay out two non-solutions to this problem, the two more obvious paths which present themselves at first glance and are probably trod by the vast majority of people, which he is unwilling, but I think on some deeper level, unable to traverse. And then we will move from there into the path that he recommends, which is, in fact, the guides.
Hence, she would remain in a state of perplexity and confusion as to whether she should follow her intellect, renounce what she knew concerning the terms in question, and consequently consider that she has renounced the foundations of the Torah. Or she should hold fast to her understanding of these terms and not let herself be drawn on together with her intellect, rather turning her back on it and moving away from it, while at the same time perceiving that she had brought loss to herself and harm to her religion. She would be left with those imaginary beliefs to which she owes her fear and difficulty and would not cease to suffer from heartache and great perplexity.
So you're in a state, we had the word distress at the end of the first paragraph, and now we get our first mention of perplexity and confusion. But what I want to be clear about is that these perplexity and confusions are more like distress, or what we saw at the bottom there, heartache, than cognitive categories. It's not like, I don't know whether to buy a Toyota or Honda minivan. I'm really not sure whether to go to the beach or, you know, mountains for vacation. That's confusion. I really can't understand why Napoleon thought it was a good idea to invade Russia, right? Those are like intellectual questions you might have, but they lack the existential oomph to turn them into what Maimonides calls perplexity, but I think distress and heartache are better examples. So I just want to be clear, the pathos, the storminess, the angst of the situation are full bore. This book is here to address that. And here are the options. One, whether to follow your intellect, renounce what she knew. So let's say, for Maimonides, the example is God doesn't have a body. Okay, and some of the problems are it says that God took us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm. It says that when the Israelites complained about the food in the desert, God's nostrils flared, et cetera, et cetera. So what does that mean? So one is renounce what she knew concerning the terms in question, i.e., the Torah is wrong, right? I'm going to follow my intellect. God doesn't have a body. Therefore, God doesn't have nostrils. The Torah is wrong. And consequently consider that she's renounced the foundations of the Torah. Well, I'm saying the Torah is wrong. I'm going to leave. Okay? Or, you know, and that's leave intellectually, right? You could still be orthoprax. You could still act observantly. But you've checked out mentally and emotionally. Or option two, you could hold fast her understanding of these terms. Say, well, the Torah says that God has a nostril. And not let herself being drawn on together with the intellect. I know indubitably, as certainly as I know anything, that God doesn't have nostrils, but the Torah says it. So I have to try to believe it. Rather turning her back on it and moving with the intellect, I loved you, we had a good run, but I have to go with the Torah. I'm going to have to leave you. And here's the amazing line. Well, at the same time, perceiving that she had brought loss to herself and harm to her religion. So the loss to herself is, that's easier to see, right? You're like, I love the intellect. It loved me. I've given it up to try to contort myself into the shape of a normal person of this community. The loss to her religion is more interesting, right? What Maimonides seems to be claiming is once you've done this, once you've hollowed yourself out by renouncing core parts, not just of who you are, but of the work you've done to become a person, you can't really believe anything anymore. And in that sense, okay, Nina doesn't like this. I'm going to invite you to chime in. I'm going to describe this choice because this is where the most apt example I have here is conversion therapy. The Torah says, I have to be straight. I have been part of a community, a queer community, that's been allowed me to, find that. I mean, I'm not speaking personally here, but on behalf of students and friends, discovered that that's not who I am. So I have this choice. One is I can leave. I can renounce the externals of the Torah. So yeah, the Torah says, can't be gay, that's wrong. Or you can't, participate in intimacy. Or I can say, well, that is who I am, but I'm going to try to be someone. The best case scenario is you would fail, right? My money is saying the worst case scenario is you would succeed and you would destroy yourself in the process. So this, I want to start pointing out here that this is not a kind of straight on Athens, Jerusalem situation, right? That's how Shestov and Matthew Arnold and then later famously Leo Strauss described Maimonides' thought, the tension between Athens, Greek intellect, and Jerusalem, the Torah, faithfulness. And here in paragraph two, Maimonides has shown us that that's not right. Strauss is actually a terrible reader of Maimonides, brilliant, but terrible reader of Maimonides, because Maimonides says that you need to follow your intellect in order to be living religiously. Now, it also causes problems, but you also need it, if that makes sense. And because if you succeeded, you would be left to those imaginary beliefs. Now, imaginary means lies, to which she owes her fear and difficulty. You don't feel, again, these aren't just like, well, that's not true. These are things that have scare you and harm you and would not cease to suffer heartache and great perplexity. Okay, so Margalit and then Nina, you've been dropping some comments in the chat, so I want to make sure you see. What if you just ignore these harmful sentences and believe what is meaningful to you from the Torah? So I think that is a good approach. Judith Plasky, I was going to attack that a little bit. We might get to it today or if not on next week. So the thing that Maimonides would say there, or I would say, I don't know if Maimonides would say it, is, at that point, Margalit, you're not really in relationship with the Torah. You're in relationship with yourself and you take certain parts, but it doesn't have any authority. It can't teach you anything. You don't really love it. I that's how I relate to Shakespeare. I read the plays I like. I don't know, it's like, fine. Okay. It's another book on your shelf, but all of the eros, all of the power is drained out of it. Now, I just want to pause here to frame this dichotomy, which I think Nina doesn't like. Okay, let's imagine you're feminists for a moment. Hopefully we all are feminists, but maybe some of us aren't, right? So circa 1975, when Plaskow is writing Standing Again at Sinai, which we'll get to in a little bit, right? So Plaskow could say, my options are, option one, I could follow my intellect, right? This is the what I've learned, who I've become in the process of the consciousness raising sessions. I didn't actually at Yale Divinity School. And renounce the patriarchy of the Torah, which, by the way, most feminists of 1975 did, right? They were like, yeah, religion is patriarchal. I mean, Plaskow's got this. Or I could go the other way and say, well, yeah, religion is patriarchal, and I need to be a religious person, so I'm going to stop being a feminist. And so the reason I want to highlight that example is in Plaskow's life, the one thing most observant Jews and most feminists agreed on was that feminism and Torah were incompatible. And Plaskow was a very lonely person, just as in Maimonides' time, most people agreed that the Aristotelian philosophy and the Torah were incompatible. And in this situation, it's not, again, that Plaskow or Maimonides is refusing the choice of the dichotomy. It's that they're fundamentally unable to choose because there's a belief that my intellect and the Torah grow out of the same wellspring. Right, my belief in human redemption and the equality of all people and the Torah grow out of the same wellspring. And therefore, I can't be one or the other because they're the same and they're both me. And so now the project, the third route, is the guide. Okay, well, now I have a hard job to do, which is to try to read these together, to try to live them together. Okay, Nina, you keep coming with this external question. So, okay, just very, very briefly, Maimonides has a very rich account of the parable, which is, again, what he says, the Torah is that parables have external meanings. You know, in Aesop's fables, no one cares if there was a rabbit and a tortoise, right? And, you know, we might call it literal, but it's a little bit less than literal, right? In Romeo and Juliet, no one cares if the town's name is Verona, right? So it's actually, the reason I don't want to call it literal is I don't think you would say it's a literal reading of Romeo and Juliet to say it's a history book about a certain few months in Verona. It's a genre error, right? I mean, the genre, it carries certain descriptions of time, places, and people. And you can read it on that level, but you're not reading the book for what it is. And is that right? I mean, it's not like, oh, I had a literary reading of Romeo and Juliet, and I put together the plot line. Like, that's not, you know, we need the plot line, but that's not what it's about. Yeah, so I would say, Sophie, that's accurate. Did he write it for those people? He wrote it really, I mean, for one student, he said. So I'll just try to answer Abby's question there. The harm to religion, Abby, would be that the type of person who has rejected certain core parts of who they are can't really be a believer in anything after that. And so you can't really believe in Torah or God. Right, you need to take the core parts of who you are as the building blocks of belief. And since you don't have those, you're the hollowed out shell of a person. And in that sense, you've harmed religion. Okay, there's questions about the authority of the Torah and what does it mean to have a favorite book, even if you don't accept everything about it? Margalit posted this here. So I want to just say a little bit about that. And Ariana, you have your hand, so I'll call on you in a second. You know, I think there's, let's say it this way. The idea that the Torah is true is what Maimonides is after. Anything less than that is a huge loss. And that's, you know, and so I have this favorite book, but I don't, you know, love every part of it. It's not quite things are, that book is true. And Maimonides will settle for nothing less than that. He'll take radical steps to preserve it.
I was just wondering if the external is like in contrast to internal readings like the Sod and Kabbalistic readings that were becoming more popular at his time.
Okay.
Like, is he intentionally making that?
Yeah, so he is not, but you're not on the wrong track. Maimonides is deeply influential on the Kabbalists. And also, it's awesome to see you again. It's been too long since we've learned together. So just very, very briefly, I think the most helpful distinction here is, and I'll mention this again later, a distinction that Daniel Boyarin, the contemporary professor and literary scholar, makes between texts where their meaning, imagine you're sitting in front of a text, like you're sitting in front of the Zoom world. So I imagine there's some texts where the meaning occurs between the text and the world, right? This physics textbook describes how light bends. This history textbook tells me what happened in sub-Saharan Africa in the 17th century, right? It maps onto the world. Now, also, I have to speak to me as a reader, but it's in kind of corresponding to the world that the text means. There are other texts, literature, right, where the meaning of the text occurs between the reader and the text. Fair Verona doesn't exist. I don't care who was king of Denmark, you know. I've just read Redwall, right? I don't care that, you know, mice can't be friends with badgers. But it occurs as I experience, think about the characters, the choices they made and moved. For Maimonides, the Torah read externally is reading it as a fact book. Internal readings are when you read it as literature. Does that make sense? Now, that idea actually does show up in the Zohar.
Like in terms of the context, if Maimonides is thinking about the Kabbalistic readings at all, or if he's not, doesn't care about
them. He's not. And I think here's actually a critical difference. So I think the external, for Maimonides, the internal reading does not sit deeper within the text. The internal meaning occurs when a strong reader who's possessed of this knowledge demands that the text speak truth. And what we'll see actually, and Spinoza hates this, is that different strong readers, depending on what different priors they bring to reading the text, will discover different internal meanings. Right, that the meaning does, and that's different than a Kabbalistic metaphysics where you go deeper into the text. For Maimonides, you don't go into the text. There's a surface of the text, and then there's what occurs between you and it. Which so that actually I think is kind of metaphysically important, and that's the way Maimonides in this way is the great enemy of Kabbalah, right? Because the Kabbalah is this assertion that there are essences, you know, and including something troublingly, Jews and non-Jews have different essences. Men and women have different essences. The land of Israel has a different essence than the rest of the world. The Torah has a different essence than other books. Maimonides rejects all of that, right? For Maimonides, all that the word holy means is that more commandments attach to it. There's no essences. And what we'll see him, you know, and it's very interesting movie, in some ways, perhaps troubling the way he goes so far on this. But this is the perplexity. So I just want to describe here that and if you scroll to the bottom of the source sheet, we're not going to do it right now, but you can look. I've tried to kind of outline the thinking here to make it clear. But perplexity is a choice. I'm sorry, is an experience, which I'm going to use a distinct word. I wouldn't say he's okay with different people coming to different results, but he thinks it will happen. He thinks he's right. If that makes sense. But he's aware that other readers will come to other interpretations. He's a hermeneutic thinker in that way, right? He understands that the reader is a part of the meaning of the text. Now, I want to say that perplexity is heroic. Now, I mean something actually very specific by the term heroic, which is excellent behavior, which cannot be expected of or demanded of most people, right? It's actually one of the really interesting critiques of standard Western moral philosophy, Kantianism, utilitarianism, contractualism, is that they can't formulate heroism, right? If you're supposed to act for the greatest good for the greatest number, you need to run into the burning building, even if you'll die to save three people, because that's what would bring the greatest good to the greatest number. If that's your duty, that's what you do. There's not a formulation of, well, here's what we can expect of most people, and there's a heroic thing, which is above and beyond that, which I think we all know to be true. The reason I'm saying perplexity is heroic, or kind of standing in the perplexity is heroic, is because it's so hard, right? Most people will be like, okay, look, at the end of the day, when I experience these, you know, like Plaskow or Cynthia Ozick writes about this beautifully, when I look back and I see how the fact that, you know, all of these rabbis for over a millennium who said that the thing that they cared most about was the study of Torah didn't shed a single tear for all the Torah studies that women were denied of in their generation, that's a moment of crisis. And it's really easy to walk out the door and be like, you know what? These guys actually all valued, they say they valued Torah, but they all valued patriarchy more when the chips are down and I can't be in this tradition. And it's also really tempting to say, look, I love the Torah so much, I can't handle this cognitive dissonance. And maybe even when I see people start reading philosophy or become feminists, they get less observant, their community study less Torah. We can't do that, right? And Maimonides is—I wouldn't say he's sympathetic, but he understands both those people. It's heroic to say, well, I can't tell you how or why it's the case that when I look back in the tradition, I don't find anyone like myself. And when I look around today, I don't really find anyone like myself. But I really believe this, and I'm going to devote my life to it. Like, that is a very special thing. You know, it's like being a civil rights activist in America in like 1910, right? You know, it's like before the other people come along, right? So that's kind of the project. Let's see, Andrew, if you could share the screen again, we're going to move a little bit forward. Oh gosh, we only have 15 minutes. We're not going to get to everything. Now, I want to just show you one more thing. We'll read through this one a little bit more quickly. I just want you to see that Maimonides is really committed to this this type of perplexity here. Max, can I ask you to read this, the Mishnah commentary from Brachot from 9? This is the very end. He's talking about reward and punishment here. Would you, look what he says about how perplexity is a feature. And Daphne and others, it's possible under the view options menu on Zoom to also zoom in yourself.
All the previous Torah scholars who have pursued this topic, reward and punishment, have achieved nothing. They are like our stages of blessed memory said, Bava Kamma chapter 8, you dove into the mighty depths and emerged with a shard of pottery. If it seems to you...
Nothing, right? You dove for pearls and all you got was some broken trash.
If it seems to you that something they said has the force of truth or is a solid argument, it isn't. If you look more closely, the veil will be removed, and you will see that it can be refuted. Eventually, you will be back where you started, despite many words and long books.
Devastating. Just devastating, right? So what he's saying here, again, he said, you might think that there's no problem. You're wrong. Okay, he's trying to shake you out of your complacency. He said, I'm aware that people have written long books. Oh, sorry, one thing. My son is home. The day between school and summer camp, so he's calling for me. One second. Now, so I just wanted you to see that. I just actually first time came across this passage 2 weeks ago from a footnote in a different book. It said it was saying something very different, but I'm grateful nonetheless. So, Max, if you want to keep going now, we're going to actually look at a different kind of failure of reading because I want you to experience something similar. So Maimonides, the context here, this is in his Mishnah commentary. Where he's laying out the 13 principles. This is the eighth principle about revelation, which is the first part of which actually lays out a very kind of austere, conservative picture of God dictating the Torah. But the second part, which we're going to look at, is about the content of how one ought to read the Torah. And he's working here off of a Midrashic tradition. So Max, take it away just with this first paragraph.
There is no difference between, and the children of Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, Canaan. The name of his wife was Mechetavel, daughter of Matred, and I am God, Exodus 22. Hear, O Israel, God is our God, God is one. All of it is from the mouth of the Almighty, and all of it is the perfect, pure, holy, true Torah of God. Manasseh, an evil king of Judah, only became the worst of all heretics, according to them, Chazal, because he thought that the Torah had an inner part and a shell, and that all of these dates and stories had no utility. And Moses said them from his own mind.
Okay, let's stop there for a sec before you scroll down. So the picture here, just to be clear, is that this is a different type of failure of reading, right? Here, the text isn't terrifying. It's just boring. Right? If your task is to extract a living Torah that's inspiring, you know, I remember this when I was getting into learning Torah as like a 19-year-old. I was like, well, which is harder, the book of Leviticus or the book of Joshua? Right? Is it the details I can't understand or is it the genocide? Well, it's both. And Maimonides is describing both here. And here he's describing just like that first path, right? The people who said, well, I disagree with the externals of the Torah. Right? Okay, there's not much here in these dates. The Shema is the real stuff, and, you know, maybe love your neighbor as yourself is the real stuff. This other stuff, the inner part, the shell, can be cast away, right? No utility. And i.e., when someone says, and this is just, we'll put a placeholder on this, but the Wednesday class about Revelation, we'll talk more about this. He's saying, when someone says, Moses said this verse, not God, Maimonides says, I don't care about that as a historical claim. I care about it as an interpretive claim, that there's no utility in it. Or as I one time heard a Dvar Torah, someone was being a little bit theologically free, said that the redactor had a bad week, this Parsha, right? It's like, okay, this isn't very well put together. That's the kind of move here.
Chazal said that this is the meaning of Torah is not from heaven. If someone says that the entire Torah is from God's mouth, except for one verse, which was not said by God, but rather by Moses on his own, this person has spurned God's word. Rather, every letter holds wonders and wisdom for one to whom God has granted insight. These can never be fully plumbed, for they are wider than the earth and broader than the sea. A person must pray as David did, "Open my eyes that I may see wonders from your Torah."
Right. Nicely read. So the idea here is the commitment, the kind of the faith commitment is in the infinity of the Torah. So again, just similarly we had before, right? The problem I would have is the Torah is bad. I'm committed, even though I haven't seen a picture of it yet into how it's meaningful. The problem here is the Torah is boring. I'm committed, even though we haven't figured it out yet, to there being infinite life-giving meaning here. The thing I want to just pause to say before we finish up with Plaskow is, and if you could just turn off the screen share for a second, Andrew, I think there's a maybe a helpful intervention here in how we think about Maimonides. And what I mean by that, and maybe how we think about kind of Judaism and living as Jews more broadly, it's often the idea that Maimonides is reconciling two bodies of ideas. One is Aristotelian philosophy, and one is the ideas of the Torah. And that's hard to do, because they seem to contradict, but he does it. Similarly, about being Jews, we often think, well, we have live in the modern world, and we're also Jews, and there's different ideas. You know, there's ideas of equality and freedom in the modern world. There's ideas of community in Judaism. How do you reconcile those, et cetera? There's ideas of all people being the same in the modern world. There's ideas of that, but also particularism in Judaism. How do we reconcile that? But what we're doing is we're trying to knit together or round off the sharp contradictions between different bodies of ideas. And what I want you to see at this stage is that Maimonides is not dealing with any ideas. And what I mean by that is a kind of weird thing to say, right? On the one hand, instead of saying in the modern world, we live here, or he lives in Aristotelian philosophy, he is describing his experience as a thinking reader. This text is boring. I know this to be true. It's a core part of who I am. I've learned through hard work that, or traditions transmitted to my family, that these things are evil. You know, it's those core parts of who you are. So first, instead of the ideas of Aristotelian philosophy or modernity, we have our identities, the kind of basic, most vibrant parts of who we are and how we create on the one hand. And then here's the big thing, which I say, like, the Torah also is not a set of ideas. It is an organic entity. Now, when you read words, you have ideas. So I'll just give a couple examples of this. Moshe Halbertal, the contemporary philosopher, calls this emunah milulit, which we would mistranslate as literal faith. It's belief in the words. And the example he gives, which I use on an almost daily basis, if you were to convince me in the next 8 minutes of this Zoom call that I had misunderstood the Shema my whole life, I would not say, damn it, I just wasted all billions of hours. I would say, well, that's really interesting. I'll keep that in mind also when I say the Shema tonight. Because my relationship to the Shema is not a relationship to the ideas that the Shema ostensibly stands for. It's a relationship to those words as sounds, as visual images, as a musical tune, as the site of interpretation. The meanings are also an important part of that. And it's like my relationship to my children. Right? My son, Rafael, there. It's not like I relate to him because he stands for the idea of improving the world. I love him as him. Right? I hope he'll do and imagine and believe he'll do great things, but there's no going further than that. It's not like the belief is grounded in something deeper or truer. This is the thing itself. This is one other example. I was at a really interesting drama workshop where we tried to use the idea of rehearsal versus plays to think about Slichot versus the High Holidays. And the director was saying, he said, you know, when I direct a play, my one rule for actors is that they try to be accomplishing something with every line as they say it. It can be something different each night when they're putting on the play. You just have to do something with it, because what we're doing is, it's not like King Lear means X. King Lear is an opportunity for people to interact. I mean, X one night, I mean Y the other night. And so the picture, I mean, the Torah is a thing, which I'm committed to having infinite meanings, right? That we're going to discover, some of which we figured out, some of which we haven't. People will disagree with us. So does that make sense? So we started with ideas and ideas. The ideas of the teachings of the Torah, the teachings of Aristotelian philosophy, the teachings of the Torah, teaching of modernity. And what I've tried to suggest is for Maimonides, the first set of ideas don't matter because they're ideas. They matter because they're actually the things we use to as anchors in the world, and as our sails also, to mix the sailing metaphor. And the second things also aren't ideas. The Torah is it's like the plot of land that's inherited by a family that you tend to. Oh, and I got a private message about the previous passage. What I just wanted to say in the previous passage, it was Maimonides saying that there's a group of Jews who think that Judaism has resolved certain questions. And Maimonides thinks that that's nonsense. All they've produced is a bunch of meaningless books. But if we look hard, we'll see that it's nonsense. And it's an achievement to see that it's nonsense, right? That's actually a higher state. So that's what I was trying to say. Just that picture that some people are untroubled, but Maimonides thinks that they're inferior religiously to the people who are troubled. And I was just trying to give you another picture where he says that in a different context. Does he think there's no resolution, only resolution? Okay, these are the questions. Good thing we have 7 more weeks. I want to give you one picture of what this can look like. How do you do it, right? Okay, how do you create something beautiful? That's the project, right? So I want to look at what I think is one of the greatest examples and pieces of just American Jewish writing period. So Andrew, if you could share the screen, and Abby, I'm going to ask you to read this bit of Plaskow. We're going to go just a couple minutes over. I'm going to warn you all, but we started a couple minutes late also. So this, The Coming of Lilith, is Plaskow's collected essays. Preaching Against the Text was a commencement address she gave to an HUC rabbinical school class, responding to one of her friends, who was a rabbi, saying they'd been trained in rabbinical school never to preach against the text. So here is Plaskow's response. She's taking as her text the image of God as a violently abusive husband in Hosea.
To wrench what we like out of context and ignore the rest is to engage in a kind of pretense, to act as if we were deriving our values from tradition, when what we are actually doing is seeking support for our own convictions. Such intellectual dishonesty might be excused were it to serve a spiritual purpose. But I would argue that failure to grapple with the hard parts of tradition is spiritually and socially corrosive because it leaves destructive ideas intact to shape our consciousness and affect our hearts and minds.
Okay, so just to pause here. So the first method of dealing with the hard stuff, which some people have been advocating, is to avoid it. Okay, the week when the picture of Hosea as an abusive husband is the Haftarah, don't speak about the Haftarah. Speak about an upcoming holiday. Speak about, something in the New York Times. Speak about the Parsha. Speak about the Siddur. Just leave that over there. Plus, you're saying, but you're still leaving it. It's like a Chekhov's gun. It's like loaded ammo for someone to come and use. That's problem number one. It's still there. You read it, and it's sitting there unmetabolized, doing its work. But there's a bigger problem, which is just more amazing here. So keep going, Abby. You're doing a great job.
Remaining silent about the negative aspects of tradition not only leaves them to do their work in the world, it also deprives us of an important spiritual resource. In congregations, hillels, and in other places rabbis serve, many Jews are in pain. Sometimes they are in pain and feel they have been wounded directly by some aspect of Jewish tradition. More often, they have been hurt by injustices or abuse described and sometimes reinscribed by tradition. In either case, what they frequently need and seek is not simply spiritual ideals they can counterpose to the bitterness of their experiences, but places to name and explore the contours and causes of their pain. We turn and grapple with ambiguity and ugliness and force them to yield up meaning.
Okay. So what Plaskow is saying is when you're standing in a congregation, a couple hundred people, there are people who are survivors of abuse. There are people who right now are in abusive relationships. And she said, if you insist on only speaking about nice things from the pulpit, the only things that are going to happen in public are nice, you are continuing the hierarchy where public is nice and bad things are marginal and shameful. She says, you could imagine a different world in which someone who's a survivor in abusive relationships gives the Devar Torah that week and says, you know what? I actually have privileged access to the meaning of this text because of my experiences. And experiences of pain and shame and loss and rupture become part of the public space that we all talk about. I always get goosebumps when I think about it. First of all, it's true. And Andrew, if you could turn off the share there for probably the last time. First of all, just the power of what such a community looks and feels like, and the courage it requires, primarily for the people who speak, but also for the people who listen. And that's the main thing. But the second thing I just want to point out is that what Plaskow has done here is a hermeneutic revolution. I mean, there's nothing greater. It's at least the greatest one since Maimonides in the last 850 years, because we all want, let's stipulate for now, the Torah to be, we all need the Torah to be revelation. And there was an implicit assumption until Plaskow came along that to be revelation, something needs to be beautiful. So when there were ugly parts of the Torah, we had to marginalize them. We had to exclude them. We had to ignore them so we could focus on the beautiful parts. And Plaskow, in those two paragraphs, not really that one paragraph, the second one, showed us how something can be revelation, not despite the fact that it's ugly, but precisely because it's ugly, by providing us with a matrix to hold the ugliness of human life and center it. Yeah, and Emily, exactly. I mean, and she described it right there. Sometimes these abuses happen within the Jewish community, they're re-inscribed by the Jewish community, sometimes they're outside, but we need a place to metabolize them with others. And that is an incredible example of how you might make good on a Plaskowian project, on a Maimonidean project, right? The externals of this text are ugly. I am committed to it being an ultimate source of meaning to its readers that will open up wonders. That doesn't mean I'm just going to become a yes man for it, kind of download it and act it, right? But in the interaction between the reader and the text, revelation will occur, or in this case, maybe between me listening to someone else read it through their experience. So that we're going to do, there's a lot more for us to do. There's literary pieces, there's a million and one things. We'll look at some of the texts of terror where God does have a body, what Maimonides make of them. We'll also look at Maimonides sometimes getting mean and nasty about Jews he doesn't like, which can be make people nervous, but also can make you laugh. And we'll look at some of the legal thinking. There's like a lot more for us to flesh out who this man was, his relationship to the body and the mind and to love. But what I wanted to just give you a picture of is how high the stakes are for him and for us. And to give you a sense that when we line up the kind of columns of who's doing radical things, that within Judaism and even trying to kind of break the tradition open in some ways, that column, Maimonides goes in that new column right alongside of Judith Plaskow, right alongside, you know, 19th century Zionists who are derided as heretics, right? Maimonides should sit there. And to the extent that you feel distress when you read the Torah, you love it and it hurts you, know that you have not only a fellow traveler, but Maimonides, someone almost sort of the stature of a patron saint. I want to offer one last thing. I got some private chats, which I think were very apt to point out. You know, I was using the term identity for these core commitments, and that is different. And Judith Plaskow said this to me. She came to one of my lectures about this, where I made this kind of claim that Plaskow's thought and Maimonides are similar. This isn't the identity just, oh, I'm a man. Oh, I'm Jewish. This identity is actually something you acquire through labor, right? It's a truth that you've come to know. So it's not identity in the sense of identity politics, whatever those are, right? Or it's not, oh, I just share this identity with a lot of people. You have to earn it. It doesn't just happen. I mean, there are identities that just, and kind of bodies of knowledge that people just have conservatively because that's how they've entered into the world and have moved through it unthinkingly. Maimonides doesn't put any interpretive stock in those, right? It's only the work we've done. So, right, you know, to play on Beauvoir, as Plaskow said, I mean, what is not born but becomes a feminist? It takes work to get to this type of crisis. And I think that's an important corrective here. It's not just, oh, well, I'm you know, fit, checked off box X on the census, therefore I have thoughts A, B, and C. That's not at all the game we're playing.